Well, it's a real pleasure to be here, and I'll start this talk by thanking the Perimeter Institute for its hospitality. I've been here since mid-January, and I'll stay here till mid-July. It's on. Can you hear me? It's a bit too quiet. It's on. I don't know if you can adjust the volume. Can you hear me? I can't hear you. Can you hear me?
We can't hear you.
You can hear me. Okay. You cannot hear me. I'm going to need to shout. Okay, is it better now? Can you hear me in the back?
No.
Yeah? Okay. Okay, thank you. Okay. So it's a real pleasure to be here, and I'd like to thank the Perimeter Institute for its hospitality and the Emmy Noether program. This is, I like that picture of Emmy Noether laughing. So today I'll be talking about modifying gravity. And before I get there, maybe I should give some motivations on why would we want to modify gravity. After all, the theory of general relativity is one of the theories which has enjoyed the most success experimentally, all the way down to sub-millimeter scales, all the way up to cosmological scales. The theory of general relativity is a real success. And probably these experiments within, observations within the solar system, this is, for instance, the lunar laser ranging experiment that measures the distance between the moon and the Earth and allows us to give us the advance of the perihelion of the moon. This experiment, together with the timing of binary pulsars, are probably the observation experiments which are really pinning down the theory of general relativity as being the best test for the best theory for gravity. In particular, this binary pulsar timing is an indirect detection of gravitational waves, which is one of the very predictions of the theory of general relativity. And now it's quite timely to talk always about the biceps result, which again would be, if confirmed, would be another indirect detection of gravitational waves, and maybe another indirect success of general relativity. And one of the aspects of bicep 2 results, if they are confirmed, is that really they would tell us that gravitational waves, at least the primordial ones, would be quantized in an effective field theory sense, as we would have expected naively from a theory of general relativity. So this is a real success. So in view of all these successes, you might really wonder, why on earth would I want to modify the theory of general relativity when it's doing so well? And I could give you a lot of reasons of why I like to modify gravity. I think all of us has their own reasons, and it could be an all new talk about that. Some people like to modify the theory of gravity for dark matter, some other for dark energy, some other to solve the cosmological constant problem, and I've been guilty of some of these things. But throughout this talk, I'm going to remain quite agnostic on the very gain one might have from modifying a theory of general relativity or getting another theory of gravity. And I really take the road that if we really want to say that GR is a very successful theory for gravity, we want to see how successful it is compared to other theories, and we need to have some alternatives, descriptions of gravity. And so I'll just propose a few alternative descriptions of the theory of gravity and see how well they do compared to general relativity. And I really just take the road or the approach that while modifying the theory of gravity, we might learn things along the way. There are actually going to be some potentially bad surprises along the way, which gives us the opportunity to learn much more physics and potentially understand whether these modifications of gravity have a way to live theoretically, or whether just from a pure theoretical point of view they're not consistent, and therefore general relativity would really be the only potential theory, both from an observational and from a theoretical point of view. So now that I can modify gravity, the first thing you need to be worried about when modifying gravity, and usually you can't evade, is the existence of new degrees of freedom. So in general relativity, gravitational waves have two polarizations, and this is a unique prediction from general relativity, these two transverse polarization of gravitational waves. But if you modify gravity, in principle, you could have up to 4 additional polarizations, which I categorize them as 2 as vectors. This is really abusing the language. But these vector polarizations don't do very much, and they go along the line of propagation and along the transverse line of propagation of the gravitational waves. And it could be 2 scalar polarizations of the gravitational waves, one which is longitudinal and one more for breathing or conformal mode. So there could be up to 4 additional polarizations leading to 6 degrees of freedom. And this extra polarization, mainly these 2 scalar degrees of freedom, they would violate the equivalence principle. And in principle, they would lead to modifications of observation from gravity. So in order to be consistent with observation, we need to make sure that the theory of modified gravity, if they have these extra degrees of freedom, they are there in such a way that they don't lead to large violation of the equivalence principle, let's say. And in modifying theories of gravity, there's been different roads. This is a graph I had a few years ago. In the meantime, this has extended a lot in all the directions, really. You can take different roads. You can think of modified gravity. Let's just screw the whole standard model and everything, and let's just not even think about Lorentz invariance as something fundamental. Then you can violate Lorentz invariance, and you can think of gravity as a theory that does that. Or you want to preserve Lorentz invariance, then usually you take gravity as being mediated by a spin 2 particle. Not always. In some cases, it could be a higher spin. It can never be really a lowest. Well, I don't know. Let me not just say that. I'm not going to take the approach of it being a lower spin. And if it is a spin 2 field, it can remain a massless spin 2 field, like in general relativity, but it's modified due to the existence of additional degrees of freedom, which are not really intrinsic of the in the graviton itself, but more due to the coupling of this graviton to the rest of the standard model or the rest of matter. So this is still, I would say, more like GR plus a non-nominally coupled scalar field in your theory. Or you can keep gravity as a spin 2 particle, but give it a mass, and this corresponds to these theories of modified gravity. In that case, in most of these cases, the degrees of freedom that arise in these theories are really intrinsic to the graviton itself, and even the way the helicity 2 polarization of the graviton propagates could be different than in general relativity. So it's not just the existence of additional degrees of freedom. And how these degrees of freedom are screened, if you want, or how these degrees of freedom could be present and yet not being observed from observations depend on the very context you're dealing with, depends on the different theories. For instance, in Lorentz violating theories, most of the time, the new degrees of freedom could, or in some cases, they could not even not be there. You're free to set them to zero in some cases. But if they are there, the reason we don't observe them is because they couple very weakly to the rest of the standard model. So there's no direct screening necessary here. It's just this degree of freedom don't want to communicate with us very much. If you're thinking of gravity as a spin 2 field, a massless spin 2 field, but you're thinking of it non-mini coupled to the rest of the standard model, you have some scalar tensor theories. In many of these models, including F of R, the new degree of freedom, which is a scalar degree of freedom, will be screened via what is called a chameleon mechanism now, where effectively in the vicinity of matter, its mass becomes very large. And so it freezes itself. Then the symmetron is actually a nice example, which was proposed by Kurt Hinterpitcher, who might be here, I don't know, and Justin Curry, for which the screening mechanism is a combination of this weak coupling to the rest of the matter sector and the chameleon mechanism. It's kind of a hybrid mechanism. But it's something of its own. And then finally, the other theories of modified gravity, which have other degrees of freedom, lying in this category, screen the degree of freedom. I don't know why it's blurry. Screen this degree of freedom via a Wahnstein mechanism, which is also sometimes called a kinetic chameleon mechanism. Rather than making the field very massive in the vicinity of matter, it makes the kinetic term of the field very large, and that effectively freezes or decouples that field to the rest of the standard model in the vicinity of matter. And this is really the mechanism that I'm going to be interested for the whole of this talk, because I'm more interested in theories lying in that category, but this is just my take on it. So let me consider a theory of massive gravity. And as I mentioned before, as soon as you start modifying gravity, you could have up to 6 degrees of freedom for your graviton, and potentially additional degrees of freedom if you have other scalar minimally coupled in your theory. But you know that a massive spin to fill in 4D has 5 degrees of freedom. And so if you really do excite all the 6 degrees of freedom that you potentially could in a modified theory of gravity, then you would have one additional degree of freedom compared to the 5 you should have for the massive spin to fill in 4D. And this extra degree of freedom, it has been shown, always comes in as a ghost. Is always a pathology of your theory already at the classical level, and as soon as you have this degree of freedom, you might as well throw your theory away. So any theory which excites the 6 degrees of freedom, which is called the Bolwer desert ghost, will automatically be pathological. And so if all the theories of massive gravity or modified gravity that you could come up with will automatically come with 6 degrees of freedom, we might as well stop trying to modify general relativity, because there would be no sense in it. Hopefully, there's actually ways to ensure that this degree of freedom is not present, at least classically. And all the studies that we have done suggest that it can also be absent at the quantum level. And one way to see how we can ensure the absence of this Bolwer-Desert ghost is to start with what we know, really. Let's start again from gravity, from general relativity, benign 5D. And this is quite a nice thing to do if you want to think of a theory of massive gravity in 4D, which you want to have 5 degrees of freedom, because 5 degrees of freedom is actually the number of degrees of freedom you have for a theory of general relativity for a massless spin to fill in 5D. So as long as you do the breakdown from 5D gravity down to 4D gravity the right way, you could ensure that this 6 degree of freedom is absent. And this has been done successfully now 14 years ago in the Dvalli-Gabadazzi-Parati model to provide the first realization of a 4D theory of massive gravity. There wasn't really a pole for the propagator as a finite mass, so it wasn't a clear notion of a theory of massive gravity. It was more of a resonance, what we call a soft theory of massive gravity. But already it paved the road for potential modifications of gravity without these pathologies that I mentioned before. In the meantime, galileons, which can also be seen to arise from 5D and being connected to DGP, arose, and I'll talk a lot about them, because it's through these galileon scalar fields that we'll see how the Weinstein can be realized. And from starting with 5D gravity, we can also see how we can get a theory of a hard mass graviton, where really we have a pole in the propagator of the graviton at a finite constant mass. So this is what I mean by a theory of hard mass gravity. And that as well, we ensure that we have no fifth degree of freedom. So this work on how to start with 5D gravity, GR, to obtain a theory of massive gravity in 4D, was work that we've done with Andrew Mattes and Andrew Tolley. You can see they're both very happy. Actually, working massive gravity makes people very happy usually, so I would very recommend it. The reference is hidden. It was last year, actually. And I have to say, I have to put a disclaimer here, it was easier to understand how to get massive gravity from 5D once we already knew the solutions. People have tried to do that for many years, and if you don't know the endpoint, it's actually very hard. So I'm going to provide you this construction to give some intuitive reasons of why we're thinking of this theory of massive gravity. But you could have done it starting in 5D, you could have done it in many different ways and get a theory which would have had a ghost. So it's really more of an intuition on how you get the right result, but it's in no way a proof that this theory, starting from 5D, is ghost-free. Okay, so let's start in 5D, and let's imagine the 5D as being finite, like this. And I'll be working in the Philbin formalism, so that the metric is expressed in terms of the Philbin components, like this. And I'll start with 5D GR, which are split in the ADM, in the 5D ADM, way where I have the 4D scalar curvature and an extrinsic curvature K, which corresponds to the derivative of the metric along the extra dimension. And then I should just say here, there's a square root minus G, which includes a lapse as well. And we're going to set the 5D lapse to 1. This is a gauge freedom that we are allowed to make for ourselves in 5D, because we have
five-dimensional GR, and therefore we have five-dimensional diff invariants.
Once I have five-dimensional GR, we're going to do something really awful, which is deconstruct deconstruction or split the extra dimension into different sites. And eventually, this is going to be equivalent to a Kaluza-Klein decomposition, which I'm sure we're all more comfortable with. But it's simpler to see how to obtain a theory of massive gravity in this language, actually. So I discretize the extra dimension in the field-bound formalism. And so at any given site, the four-dimensional scalar curvature will correspond to the scalar curvature of the metric at that site. But then I need to be dealing with the extrinsic curvature, which knows about connection between the two sides, between different sides. And this is really what's going to give me some interactions between different sides. So if it wasn't for that, we would get a theory of general relativity, an independent theory of general relativity at every single site. But now there's a communication between the different sides through this extrinsic curvature. And so simply performing this derivative of along the extra dimension discretization along the extra dimension in the field bind, we can substitute this derivative along the extra dimension with the difference between the value of the field bind at two different sites. And if this is quite easy to see, and if I wanted to rewrite it in terms of the metric, I would get some ugly formalism which involves some derivative and then some inverse of the metric and everything. This is ugly, but it is what it is. It's not nothing really annoying to work with, and if you don't like this square root formalism, you can also work in terms of the metric. And so what discretizing the extra dimension really means is that instead of having a continuous extra dimension, you'll have a sum of different sites where the extrinsic curvature is going to be replaced with this other k expressed in terms of the metric at each side and the metric at a neighboring site, and you could generalize that so that it communicates with most sites later on. So you have your sum of theories, which would be gravity at given site and communications with the different sides. And this communication is expressed in a very specific way, like this, with this square root structure of in the metric language. And actually, that corresponds to a theory of multigravity, which was later proposed, well, before that, but after massive gravity, proposed by Kurt Hinterblischer and Rachel Rosen. And this is a specific realization of multigravity proposed by these two people. You can generalize this multigravity by making the discretization procedure a little bit more complex and also not having communication with further neighbors. So you get a theory of multigravity there, and I'm not going to prove it here, but the fact that you started with a well-defined 5D theory ensures you in here that you don't have any ball where there's a ghost. And so this theory is a 4D ghost-free theory of multigravity. Now to get a little bit more intuition, I'll just focus on the two graviton cases, theory called bigravity, proposed by Rachel Rosen and Howard Hassan, where let me start with two theories of GR which don't communicate with one another. So I have one, can you see that? I have one copy of GR here and another copy of GR there. If I just had matter field coupling to this very metric in one way, and then a completely independent sector, matter field sector, which coupled to that metric, completely independent without any communication between the two, then I would just have two independent copies of general relativity. And in the gravitational sector for each one of them, I would have a massless spin to field, which would propagate 2 degrees of freedom. So in that theory, without counting the matter sector, we would have 4 degrees of freedom.
How much did you want to interact with the usual R4 if you want to interact with it twice that? Does it make it more separately?
Yeah, very good. So the question is, what are the symmetries of that theory? And here we have two copies of diff invariants, of nonlinear diff invariants. Two copies, yeah. Two independent copies. Can you see this pointer? You have one copy for the metric G, which I can split at this level. I can shift as I want. I can make any coordinate transformation associated with metric G as I want. And I can do an independent one for the metric F as I want. So they're all completely independent. And I have two independent copies of full diffeomorphism invariants. These are two independent copies of general relativity. And that's why I only have 4 degrees of freedom in the gravity in the full gravitational sector. This is broken when I start communicating between the two metrics. So I can add a communication between the two in the same, this U potential is using the same structure as I wrote down before with the, if you're working in the metric language, this K tensor is this ugly expression, but it doesn't matter. We ensure by keeping this expression that there's no ghost. But now, as soon as we do that, we do break one copy of diff. So you only have a diagonal copy of diff. If you want, you can shift G here, and this could remain invariant. But then if you shift G here, you better have that F would transform as a tensor under this transformation, and therefore this had to transform as well. So in this theory, as I've written it like that, we'll see later how to restore the two copies of diff, but if I just wrote it like that without the introduction of any Stückeberg field, then it will break one copy of diff. And the same thing for multigravity. So you, if you have n interacting gravitons, you would break n minus one copies of diffeomorphism invariants. Now that you have this communication between the two metrics, you have a theory of bigravity, and the spectral representation of that corresponds to one massless spin-2 field propagating 2 degrees of freedom and one massive spin-2 field propagating 5 degrees of freedom for a total of 7 degrees of freedom. It's not like this G or this F is the massless mode and the other one is the massive mode. It's a combination of both, but it doesn't really matter. And to ensure that this theory remains ghost-free, you need to couple matter to each metric G or F independently and not to a combination of both at the same time. At least that wouldn't be proven to be ghost-free. So as I mentioned before, in here you only have, by adding, as soon as you have this interaction, you've broken one copy of diff invariants, and so you could introduce 4 Stückeberg fields to restore the second copy of diffeomorphism invariants. Naively, if you introduce 4 Stückeberg fields, you would introduce, you could think you have 2 degrees of freedom for each massless, for each graviton on each sector, and then you introduce the 4 Stückeberg fields that will lead you to 4 new degrees of freedom. But this very structure of the potential of the interactions ensures that out of these 4 Stückeberg fields, only 3 actually only 3 are actually independent. So you only have 2. Plus 2 plus 3 degrees of freedom, which is again 7 degrees of freedom. And that's ensure that you project out the 8th degree of freedom, which would be the Bolloré desert ghost. So now to yet another simplification, if you want, of this bigravity, is to take the limit where one of the Planck scales, it doesn't matter which one, I'll take the F Planck scale going to infinity, it really doesn't matter, you could have taken the other way, the other one, where you actually decouple the dynamics of one of the metric. You do that by sending its respective Planck scale to infinity. And that will make the metric F decouple from the rest of the gravitational sector and the matter sector, if you have one. And what you end up obtaining is a theory of massive gravity on a fixed reference metric and a fully decoupled massless spin-2 field. Yeah? Yes, so that will be a question that I will go in depth later, but not for the bigravity, for bigravity case. But here, what you want to do here is that the matter sector, one matter sector only couples to the G metric, or an independent matter sector only couples to the F metric. So you don't start coupling a matter sector to both metric directly. So it might do that later on through the interactions, but at the linear level, it will only couple to one metric, which is not the, so the Lycoon is determined by the metric G if you are a matter sector which couples to metric G, or the Lycoon will be determined by the metric F if it's the other way around. But you don't couple to both at the same time. So now you can take the massive gravity limit, which is a decoupling limit of bigravity. By taking this limit, you're not changing any number of degrees of freedom. You're simply decoupling some degrees of freedom from one another, and you obtain a theory of massive gravity on a fixed reference matrix here, F, F doesn't have any dynamics, it's a fixed reference metric. It can be just the Minkowski metric if you want, and this is what are going to be considered for most of this talk. And then you have a fully decoupled massless spin 2 field at the Lenoir's level, and that's all it is. And then it doesn't, once you've taken the Planck, its own Planck scale to infinity, this field doesn't even couple to the matter sector it used to couple to, because it just goes to zero. So this is an entirely free massless spin 2 field. You have 2 degrees of freedom there, and here you have a theory of massive gravity which has 5 degrees of freedom, and that corresponds to the theory of Gauss free massive gravity proposed a few years ago, and then was fully shown to be Gauss free by Rachel Rosen and Farward Hassan. And that's the theory I'm going to be focusing on for the rest of the talk, really. So there again is theory of massive gravity. Here you have one copy of linearized if invariants, so that's okay. Here you've broken, if I just wrote it like this, you've broken your copy of diff invariants that you would have wanted to have if that was just your without a mass term. But you can restore diff invariants here by the introduction of 4 Schlüter-Bauer fields. So taking the reference metric, which here is non-dynamical, it can just be eta mu nu. You can promote it to a tensor by the introduction of 4 Schlüter-Bauer scalar field phi a. So this, under a coordinate transformation, this quantity is phi a transform as a scalar, each single one of them. A is a Lorentz index going from 1 to 4, if you want. And I can do this split this is a useful split because in some limit, where you send the Planck scale for the G metric to infinity, this V and this phi are actually capturing the helicity 1 and the helicity 0 of the graviton. If you're away from that limit, it becomes a bit more complicated, but it's a useful trick there. And so actually in this helicity 1, you have 2 degrees of freedom, and in this helicity 0, you have 1 degree of freedom. This is the 3 additional degrees of freedom that you have on top of your helicity 2 mode, leading to the 5 degrees of freedom. This helicity 1 doesn't couple directly to matter, at least at the linear level, and so it's relatively uninteresting for what I'm going to be talking about today. In some cosmological setup, it can have some consequences, but I'm not going to go through that. The helicity zero mode, on the other hand, does directly couple to matter, and so it'll be extremely relevant for the rest of this talk. We can show that this helicity zero mode behaves as a Galilean scalar field. Let me just go into what this Galilean is quickly. So if I forget about the helicity 1 mode, this V mode, then by introducing the Schlüter-Bauer fields, this reference metric is promoted to this tensor-like quantity where the helicity 0 mode enters like that with 2 derivatives in it. And so it's clear from its very construction, since every potential term involves this reference metric F for which pi enters with 2 derivatives, from its very construction, this theory is invariant under this, what we call Galilean symmetry, where I can shift the derivative of the field by a constant. So this is a global symmetry. And this is by construction, but it's actually one of the things fundamental behind the Galilean theory, which I'll talk a little bit about. Here we see that pi comes in with 2 derivatives in F, and so you have high powers of the 2 derivatives of pi coming in this potential term, in what constructs the potential term. And you might worry that the equation of motion with respect to pi are actually higher derivatives, and if they were, that would actually be one of the realization of the Bolognese as a ghost. This very construction of the potential is such that pi actually never really have more than 2 derivatives at the level of the equation of motion, and that's really what projects out the Bolognese as a ghost. So in this limit, which really we send the 4-dimensional Planck scale to infinity while keeping the mass of the graviton fixed, this helicity zero mode behaves as a Galilean, which actually has a lot of interesting properties. So Galileans were proposed by Nicolaes, Rattazzi, Trinciarini in 2008, and they really were introduced for the first time, they really appeared in the first time in the Dvalli-Gabadazzi model in 2000, and a few years later it was realized it came in as a Galilean, the cubic Galilean like that, actually. There are finite cluster of interactions. In four dimensions, there's only five interactions. There's also a tadpole, which I haven't included, but let me just focus on these interactions. In here, it's less obvious that they enjoy this Galilean symmetry. They only do that after integration by parts, whereas in massive gravity, they did that by construction. But it's the same symmetry. Even though you have two derivatives to a higher power coming in, they have no ghosts. The equation of motion are really only second order. And one of the nice things enjoyed by these Galilean theories, which happens in this realization of Galileans or in the massive gravity realization of Galileans, is that they enjoy a non-renormalization theorem, which means that if you only include quantum corrections of the Galilean itself, it's not going to renormalize these very operators. And so that has interesting consequences for massive gravity, since this Galilean is actually tied into the presence of the mass, and the scale at which these Galilean interactions are tied into the mass of the graviton, we can actually show that the mass of the graviton doesn't receive any quantum corrections in this limit, and that tells us, that gives us some hints on the naturalness of the graviton mass in massive gravity, which means that you can take the graviton mass to be as small as you want, and you don't expect to have large quantum corrections from a heavier field to the graviton mass. And this is something I've been working actually with Lavinia Heisenberg and Raquel Ribeiro, who are here. So this helicity zero, this Galilean, be it in a Galilean theory or being in massive gravity, it couples to the rest of the Sonnen model with a gravitational strength and certain principle, it could violate the equivalence principle. However, it exhibits in the vicinity of matter a Van Schaan mechanism, which the Van Schaan mechanism is a funny thing. The field is actually strongly coupled to itself, which means that you need to take all of the interactions of the Galilean into account. And when you do that, the perturbations, the Galilean on top of this background, are going to be weakly coupled to the rest of matter and weakly coupled to itself. But it starts with a strong coupling at the background level. And for the Van Schaan mechanism to work out, it's absolutely crucial that these nonlinear interactions that come in here are important. They are really the bread of the screening mechanism for the helicity zero mode. And for them to be important, it means that they need to arise at an energy scale, which I'll be calling lambda. And this lambda is just the energy scale at which the Galilean, the interactions for the Galilean enters for this talk. It does not need to be in the cutoff of the theory, even though I call it lambda, for this talk. But you need this strong coupling scale, or the scale of the interactions, to be much smaller than the Planck scale. Because if you were at the level of the Planck scale, the interactions would never start becoming really relevant in the regime of interest, and you would lose this Van Schaan mechanism. And so this theory would be ruled out by violation of the equivalence principle. So one of the fundamental questions that I'll be talking a little bit at the end of this talk is whether we can really trust these irrelevant interactions that come in at such a low energy scale, or whether we need to be worried that they'll be ruled out while they'll be dominated, over-dominated by quantum corrections. So let me just quickly give you a cartoon view of how the Van Schaan mechanism works before I go into the problems with the Van Schaan mechanism. I'll focus here in the cubic Galilean, just as an example. So you have the cubic interaction, you have the standard kinetic term which couples to matter, but now you have new interactions that come in, and these interactions are actually the ones that dominate in the vicinity of a large matter field, external matter T. So let's imagine we have the sun present there, and that's going to source a large background configuration for the field pi. Let me call that background configuration pi zero. And now on top of this background field configuration, I'll have fluctuations which will see an effective metric Z, which depends not on, it's not just the E time you started with, but it depends on the background field configuration. And so if you're in the vicinity of large matter, like a large source like the sun, you have this pi zero, in particular the second derivative of pi zero, the lambda three, which was going to be large. And so this effective coefficient in front is going to be extremely large, and this is what's going to be responsible for the screening of the field. To see that, you can canonically normalize your field like that. And so effectively, the field looks like if it were a free scalar field, but now weakly coupled to the rest of to matter. You have this kind of normalization coming in here. And so when pi zero is large, z is large, and so the effective coupling to matter becomes small. So this is just a cartoon picture of what's going on. But it's enough, I think, to start seeing some potential troubles that would arise as soon as you want to have this functional mechanism operative. So first, as I mentioned, it relies on irrelevant operators here that arise at a very low energy scale. So the first question you might ask yourself is, can you really trust these irrelevant operators, or are you just going to be dominated by quantum corrections? So I mentioned that these Galilean theories enjoy a non-renormalization theorem, which tells you that this very operator doesn't get renormalized. So that helps fixing the scale lambda to be small without having it spoiled by quantum corrections. But that's not quite enough still to ensure that you're not going to get completely ruled out by quantum corrections. You could still have quantum corrections from this. You could still lead to quantum corrections which are arbitrarily close to that very operator and not exactly of the same form, and still completely spoil any of the classical predictions that you had expected for the Weinstein mechanism. So I'll talk about it at the end of this talk, if I have time. And one of the other problems you might have with this Weinstein mechanism, probably one of the most serious problems that you have, is that it's not like the chameleon mechanism, which relies on a redressing of the mass term, which is not defining the causal structure of your field. You redefine the mass term, but that's okay. Here you're really redefining the kinetic term, and so you're really changing the causal structure of your theory. You might really be worried about that. It's probably not a very well-defined thing to do, at least when you start with. And actually, because of this change of the causal structure, or the effective metric, which is the fluctuation of the Galilean leaving, you will be led with some classical group superluminalities, which a priori are very worrisome. And I'll be discussing about that a lot. You can really wonder whether this is going to lead to some acausalities in your theory. And these Galilean theories involving some operators like that have been shown not to have an analytic S-metric matrix at the classical level, at the perturbative level, which really means that this theory will have no Wilsonian UV completion. And when I tell that to my daughter, she gets very upset. I should say, she wasn't really upset because of that. She wasn't allowed to eat the tree. But other people are equivalently upset about the absence of Wilsonian completion. But what gives my daughter some hope that we're not doing something completely crazy, though, is that there are cases where these very same pathologies, which is the existence of superluminalities and the strong coupling issues, are present, and yet these theories are dual to another theory which is free and for which none of these pathologies are present. And so it could be, if this duality was really something a bit more fundamental, it could be that these superluminalities are something, an artifact of the description, the language in which we decide to describe this theory, but are not really a failure of the theory or pathologies in the theory itself. So this duality was shown classically. It was actually introduced within the context of bi-gravity by Matteo Fasciello and Andrew Tolley. And then we worked with this duality further in this paper. It was shown at the classical level. And what we can show, we haven't shown that yet, but what we can show is that if this duality worked at the quantum level, that would mean that this free theory at the quantum level should be completely equivalent to another theory, which is a Galilean theory, which exhibits classical superluminalities, which exhibits strong coupling issues, and yet it's free to this dual theory, so it should be fine. And so the resolution behind that should be that the group velocity computed classically in the Galilean theory can be superluminal, but what really determines the causal structure of the theory is the front velocity, which is the high frequency phase velocity, which has to be computed at the quantum level. And when including quantum corrections to the computation of this front velocity, it must bring this velocity back to a luminal one to be equivalent to the free theory the Galilean theory was dual with. And it would also mean, if the duality worked out at the quantum level, it would also mean that some of these Galilean theories, at least the ones which are dual to the free theory, are to be complete by themselves. Not through a standard Wilsonian UV completion, but UV complete by themselves. So it really, we have a lot to learn if this duality went through at the quantum level. And actually, recently, just a few months ago, there has been some confirmation that the duality was going through at least at one loop at the quantum level by these people. So that gives us hope that we're not doing something completely crazy there, at least not at that order.
Question?
Yeah. That's right.
So just
that's right. That's right.
So why are
they can still. I'll go through them. Because these types of theories are exactly what enters in massive gravity, and in that very complicated language, we do observe that they exhibit some supernormalities, which we would seem as being indicative that the theory is sick. But it could be that we're just not looking at it from the right angle.
So you have examples which can be, so it's well known that you can make a lot of theories of analogy.
That's fine. That's fine.
So you have some examples of theories which look pathological with the
field. That's right.
Is your conjecture that there are other theories which are not free?
That's right. They are all I want, if this is true, and if this duality works at the quantum level, all I would like to say is that the presence of supernormalities and all the pathologies, which we see as indications that the theory are bad, are clearly not correct indications, because they would rule out theories which are clearly fine. And therefore, we can't use them as criteria to rule out all of the Galilean theories.
But doesn't mean
no. No, it doesn't mean that. But it means that the criterion for ruling out a theory on theoretical grounds is more subtle than what we would have expected. No, I'm not claiming that all Galilean theories are fine. No. Okay, so this was the introduction of my talk, and I have 5 more minutes. No, it wasn't going. We really would like to have the Wallenstein mechanism working in this type of theories, but the Wallenstein mechanism comes in with its own of a set of peculiarities, I would say. I'll just summarize them here. We have irrelevant operators, which they rely on irrelevant operators, which might wonder whether they're really technically natural. Maybe these very operators are, but maybe operators which are pretty close to them are not, and so that would put the whole theory in trouble. And they do rely on the redressing of the kinetic structure, which comes with its own share of trouble. And so for the rest of this talk, for the amount of time I have, I'll see how the duality helps, I'll introduce the duality with this definition in the context to help with this particular set of issues in the Wallenstein mechanism and in Galileans. And then if I have time, I'll introduce an exact renormalization group that can help with dealing with these irrelevant operators. So let me introduce what I mean by this duality. It's a little bit more than a field transformation, but let me introduce it. And the easiest way to think about it is to start with massive gravity in the Stückeborg language. So I introduce 4 Stückeborg fields. Not all of them are independent, but I introduce them. And I split them in this way. And now, clearly, from this very construction, I can set a gauge where T and S are 0, that corresponds to unitary gauge, and that's what you would have had if you hadn't introduced the Stückeborg fields in the first place, because then this F mu nu is just eta mu nu. But you can keep the Stückeborg fields in, this pi field and this V field. So this just corresponds to different gauges in the theory, but clearly the theory is invariant whether I decide to call this S, S1 or S2, S prime. Clearly the theory is invariant under that. This is just a gauge choice. So these two theories are exactly equivalent. But to go from a theory, from a representation where the Stückeborg field is expressed in terms of S to another one where it's expressed in terms of S prime, I need to make a coordinate transformation.
It's just a coordinate transformation. Well, not just quite just, because it's really a field-dependent coordinate transformation. But I can do that. My coordinate change from x to an x tilde, which involves the helicity zero mode here. And under a coordinate transformation, remember the Stokoe field themselves behaves as scalars. So phi A should transform as a scalar, which means that this whole quantity should transform as a scalar, which means that pi itself is not a scalar under coordinate transformation. It's only some decoupling limit, and abusing the language that pi behaves as a scalar, Galileans are scalars. Really, under coordinate transformation, pi does not transform as a scalar. It transform, the whole thing here transforms as a scalar. And so this quantity should transform like that under a coordinate transformation. And the metric just transforms as this tensor here. And this is just the transformation matrix in the coordinate transformation. And it involves some second derivatives of the field. OK, so this is just a coordinate transformation, which allows us to go from a gauge where S is, I think I chose S is 0 here, to S prime in the dual theory. So clearly, this is not something. This is just a gauge transformation. And this map is invertible. I can go back to the original one by doing a minus the gauge transformation. And it forms a group. It's associated in that way. Now you can think this was just for the gravitational sector. If you have some matter sector, which is really what is interesting to have, or if you want the Wanstein mechanism to come in, you really need some other field to be there and to source this screening mechanism. So if you think of all the matter field coupling to this gravitational theory at this level, they will transform like you usually want them to transform under a coordinate transformation. So if you have a scalar field, if you have the Higgs field, for instance, it will transform as a scalar field under this coordinate transformation. This involves, remember, some pi in the coordinate transformation in a non-trivial way, but it will just transform like that. And the same way if you have any arbitrary tensor field. And so when you ensure that the matter field transform as they should under this coordinate transformation, if you start with a local coupling to matter in the original gauge, you end up with a local coupling to matter in the dual gauge. So a local dynamical source will map to a local dynamical source. And so whatever I'm going to say in what follows is not an artifact of non-locality issues to do with the way you're coupling to matter. So let's look at different cases where you can apply this duality. You can apply this transformation or this map going from S. I think here it's always going to be from S is 1 to S prime or something like that in different cases. So let me look at our first example where I have a. This is just the Galilean field. And then it couples to another matter field, which is chi, in this form. And this, at this level, is a perfectly fine renormalizable theory. And now I can go. And here I clearly have no ghost or nothing. All the equation of motion with respect to all the fields are clearly second order. I don't have any such stochastic instability or anything like that. Now I can perform the map that I mentioned before, where pi does not transform as a scalar, but transform dpi transforms as a scalar more. But chi does transform as a scalar. Chi is just a matter field living there. And then this theory maps into this very ugly theory, which has a lot of irrelevant operators. This M is a transformation matrix, which involves some second derivatives of the field pi. So there's a determinant of that. This is highly nonlinear. And then this z mu nu is this kind of inverse M transformation. So this is hugely nonlinear here. If it wasn't for this term, it would actually look like a Galilean theory, which would have no ghost. From here, you see that this would involve more than two derivatives at the level of the equation of motion for the field pi. And yet you know from here, you just did a gauge transformation. You know from here that the theory should not have a ghost. So here is an example of a theory where A, you let a lot of irrelevant operators, but if the duality went through at the quantum level, or at least if you did calculation at the perturbative level, it should be that this theory should be renormalizable, at least if you follow a regularization procedure which is invariant in the Fourier definition. And this theory cannot have a ghost.
So maybe in this language, it looks like you have equation of motion, which are higher derivatives, but it must be that these higher derivatives are actually derivatives of the other equation of motion in such a way that everything is finite and you only need four initial conditions to solve your whole problem. So this is not something related to massive gravity at all, but this is just one of the one example where this theory, this duality can be useful in producing other theories which a priori we just have thrown out of the window, yet they are completely fine theory because they're equivalent to this one. And it's just an example of where you could have higher derivatives and yet led to no ghost at the level of the equation of motion. Yeah. Yeah.
So you still may end up in a situation with mass that is Q, right?
That's right.
You are not, your original Q or either of the theories may require the same amount of Q.
That's right. For here, yeah. For massive gravity, this is, I completely agree, this is a completely separate question. For massive gravity, we actually have some, I'm not going to present them here, but we actually have some indication that this theory is technically natural. So you don't require fine tuning to set the graviton mass to be small. But this, I'm not saying anything about that. Yeah, absolutely. Let me take another example, which is going to be look very boring, where I start with a Galilean theory. So now there's no coupling to another matter field or anything. It's just a Galilean theory. And I perform the duality, where what you get is just another Galilean theory. And you say, okay, that sounds about right. You start with something which maybe is not well defined. You end up with something else which maybe is not well defined. So what have you got? One in the process? Well, actually, the coefficients here are not the same as the one there. That might not be super interesting. But what becomes interesting is you can set these coefficients here so that all the coefficients there are zero, or vice versa. So it means that you can actually start with a free theory, a theory which is clearly fine, and then from the massive gravity point of view, you look like you're just doing this coordinate transformation, which should be clearly fine, and you end up with a theory which is a quintic Galilean. When the S prime parameter is one, it just looks like that. This involves higher derivatives. It's just one way to express this quintic Galilean like that. And this quintic Galilean, I can definitely find some solutions which will exhibit some supraluminalities. It looks like it's strongly coupled at a scale lambda. Actually, it's not, but it looks like. It can, if you add a minimal coupling to matter, a conformal coupling to matter here, it will exhibit the Weinstein mechanism. So it will enable to screen this helices zero mode in the vicinity of matter. Yet this very theory here is dual to a completely free theory, which should be fine by itself. So let me go through. Am I running out of time? 5 or 10 minutes. Okay. So let me go through that. This Galilean theory, the dual to the free theory here, actually admits some vacuum solutions. So without even dealing with how you couple that field to matter, in the vacuum, you have some plane wave solutions which behave like that, for which, on top of these plane wave solutions, the fluctuations have along one direction a speed which is one, and along the other direction, they can have a superluminal speed within the regime of validity of that effective field theory. So you don't need to go out of control to see some superluminalities. And these are classical superluminalities in the group velocity. Here, the phase velocity is the same as the group velocity. And so if you want to use classical superluminal group velocity to discard a theory, you should also discard this free theory, and so discard the whole word, really, because this theory is simply the same thing at the classical level. And it's clearly causal, unitary, UV complete, and anything you want. This is the best theory, the simplest theory you can have. But there's no paradox here. There's no problem with one side or with the other side of the duality, and there's no problem with the map itself. The fact that you obtain some superluminal group velocity on one side and some luminal group velocity on the other side is not a paradox. The group velocity itself does not need to be invariant under this map. What needs to be invariant is the causal structure
of the theory. If one theory is causal on one side, it better be causal on the other side. But the causality is not determined by the classical group velocity. The causality of the theory is determined by the front velocity, which is the high frequency, when the frequency goes to infinity, of the phase velocity. So in these theories, when you compute them classically, within the regime of validity of their own effective field theory, the group velocity seems constant and equal to the phase velocity. And it seems to be superluminal in the Quintic Galilean theory, and it seems to be just equal to 1, and this is true at the classical and quantum level, for the free theory. But now if you want to compute something beyond this group velocity or phase velocity, it must be that when you're reaching the strong coupling scale of the theory, when you're reaching the level at which you need to include quantum corrections, this quantum correction will change the phase velocity. And as you go to higher and higher frequency, if the two theories are equivalent at the quantum level, this phase velocity must become luminal in such a way that both these theories have the same, are both causal and have the same front velocity, which is the high frequency of the phase velocity. So this is just a summary of what I said. There's really no paradox here. But we have a lot to gain to understanding whether this duality can also work at the quantum level. At the moment, as I said, we know that it works at the classical level, and there's been some indications perturbatively. But if this has to work out, you need to do more than non-perturbatively. And this is another way you can see that there's no paradox, but purely from a classical structure, classical point of view, where if you start coupling to external matter, you might end up in a configuration where you have the Galilean, which propagates superluminally, and the matter field, which propagates luminally. But you can make a dual of this theory, where the pi field, the Galilean field, might just be the free Galilean field, which propagates luminally. And the matter field in this transform, under this transform picture, will actually transform subluminally. And so here, there's no classical inconsistency. The Lycon is always set up by the Galilean picture. It can be superluminal, but this is what defining the Lycon and the field chi lives within it, is always within it. But of course, we want more than that. And if this were to work out at the quantum level, it must mean that when you compute the front velocity, you have really luminality for both the pi field and the matter field. And this is true in both pictures. So in one picture, we can show this is true for the pi field, for the chi field here, and for the pi field there. And so if the two were equivalent, it has to be the same for both of them. Let me quickly, in the last 1 minute, go through how we can try to think about these irrelevant operators and whether quantum corrections is going to make them running out of controls. I'm not going to be talking about the technical naturalness in massive gravity, but more generically in theories which do exhibit the Wein-Strom mechanism, and use for that an exact renormalization group to understand how they behave. And this is work done with Raquel Ribeiro, who is here somewhere. So consider, again, it's not a Galilean theory. It could be a Galilean theory. It doesn't really matter. Consider a theory which I want to exhibit the Wein-Strom mechanism. So I'll have the free kinetic term, you can see. And then you have some operator, I'll just put it like that. Maybe if n is larger than m, if n is larger than m over 2, maybe you start having ghosts, but that's good, not worry too much about that. So let's imagine you have these irrelevant operators here on which the Wein-Strom rely to screen your source. And so that means that the effective kinetic structure, the effective metric, if you want, when these terms become relevant, is it behaves like that and is much larger than 1. And you might be worried that the very presence of this irrelevant operator will mean that when you construct loops, you're going to generate other operators, which means, first of all, that this wasn't the only operator you should have constructed your classical theory, classical solution on, or your full solution on. And second, if you have large quantum cutoff corrections, it can make this scale technically unnatural. So you have two sorts of problems there.
Yeah. The term you're adding, is that really total group or is there a square?
No, it's like that. It's this thing. This is the second derivative of the metric with respect to the field. So it's not squared. No, this is, sorry, this is symbolic. This is n plus 2 derivatives acting on n plus 2 fields. It's symbolic. It's not like all the derivatives act on the left-hand side. There's lots of derivatives acting on lots of fields. That's all I mean. Yeah? That's all I mean. Yeah. This is not a total derivative. There's something here. It might be a Galilean if you want. And then if you were a Galilean, this just would just be box phi. I'm just being very schematic. Yeah. This is just to give a rough idea. I just need to rely on this operator to have my Rankine mechanism. And because I need to rely on this operator, I think I'm going to be in trouble. So I can see, one way I could see that I'm going to be in trouble is if I start coupling this field phi, and again, this is all schematic, to another matter field, chi, another field, and if this field has a large mass, much larger than this scale lambda. And remember, I don't want this scale lambda to be the cutoff of the theory. I just want it to be the strong coupling scale. So there's nothing a priori wrong with having a matter field which mass is much larger than lambda. Then I would expect this mass to this scale to flow into this mass and end up with this effective mass scale at the end, and also to generate a lot of other irrelevant operators, which will spoil my whole classical prediction of this theory. And so maybe I can't think of the Rankine mechanism anymore. And this is definitely what happens if you do things perturbatively. However, you can consider this is work we did in a specific model for P of X, but here I'll just give you the back of the envelope intuition for how we expect it to work for Rankine mechanism, and this is still work in progress. So if you consider the exact randomization group equation by Vetterich, which goes like that. So this tells you about, this is the exact all loop flow of the effective average action, so which depends on this infrared regulator kappa. When you introduce a regulator operator R kappa, and it doesn't matter too much where this regulator is, and I'm not going to go into that very operator in too much details. But what happens in this theory, which exhibits the Weinstein, is that at least at the lowest order in a derivative expansion, and not in a loop expansion, really in a derivative expansion, what you end up having here is really this Z mu nu, which is the kinetic metric, if you want, on which the perturbation start living in, for which becomes extremely large when the Weinstein mechanism is active. And so that means that in the limit, well, when you are deep within the Weinstein region, this quantity, the average action, stops flowing and goes to zero. And so all the quantum corrections become, to all loop, resummed if you want, become irrelevant, even though if you did a perturbative analysis, you would start seeing order by order which terms which are larger and larger, but they actually will resum in a quantity for which this structure comes in at the bottom and actually helps you making the theory better and better defined as you go well within the Weinstein region. So it's very important that this calculation is fully non-perturbative. It's not something you would have seen perturbatively. Just to give you some intuition, and I'll stop here, on how you can think about that at the level of the path integral, I put the h-bar here to see at which level the quantum corrections come in. If you're deep within the Weinstein region, well, even if you're not, you have this effective metric now for your fluctuations, and this is very different from what you would have in another kind of screening mechanism where it's really the mass term that becomes relevant. Here, it's important that it is, if you want, the wave function that becomes relevant, or the effective metric that becomes relevant. And so, effectively, that looks like an effective Planck constant which goes to zero when you dip within the Weinstein region. And so that's another way to see, maybe more cartoon-like, how you could, how the quantum corrections could actually become more and more irrelevant precisely when you thought you would need to worry the most about them. And it's because they resum to something very small eventually. So let me just finish here. I started considering theory of infrared modifications of gravity. And within the context of massive gravity, DGP, and these types of theories, it's quite generic for infrared modification of gravity, where you really want to modify the graviton itself rather than just introducing other degrees of freedom. you need the Van Schillen mechanism to screen the other degrees of freedom that come in hand with your modification of gravity. And this Van Schillen mechanism comes in naturally in the theory of massive gravity or DGP or all of these theories, but it comes in with these shares of troubles, like strong coupling issues, like superluminality issues, which are classical group velocity superluminality. In some cases, the S-matrix was shown to be non-analytic, at least perturbatively. And in most of the cases, you can show that these theories will have no UV completion. But if there is a resolution behind all of these issues, it could be that it is the very existence of the Van Schillen mechanism that makes these issues actually not as bad as you would have originally thought they would be. And I should emphasize that all of this comes in an intrinsically gravitational theory, and so sometimes when you just apply free or a normal scalar field living on flat space-time consideration to these theories, they might not be fully justified. What I've shown here is that the Galilean duality, which should just be seen as a gauge transformation, could give us some indication on why these issues might not necessarily be indicator of pathologies. And in some cases, you might have some of these pathologies, but the theory is just fine. So you would need to work a little bit harder to understand whether these theories are ruled out or not. If the duality did work out at the quantum level, it really would open up a whole set of possibilities to understanding how this new class of theories could be consistent and could yet not have necessarily Wilsonian UV completion be just finite by themselves. So at this level, I would say it's a win-win situation. Either you understand why you can never modify gravity in this sense, and you just throw away from an observational and theoretical point of view a whole set of opportunities, and it really makes the theory of generality much more unique. Or you find from a more from a field theory point of view a new way to think about these classes of theories. And I also mentioned how if you use an exact randomization group procedure, non-perturbatively, the result could be actually much better than the perturbative analysis might suggest. So I'll stop here. Thank you.
So, questions?
So for the quanta of light that have a group velocity larger than one, you rightfully say, so if you increase the frequency, you see that it will all converge to one, which has usually very transparent physics explanations because, you know, atoms that renormalize this speed of light, they decouple in the limit of infinite frequency, and everything goes to one. So, but that sort of presumes a medium, right? It's not a modification in vacuum, right? There is a medium, the atoms that do the modification of the speed of light. So here, when you talk about the all these Galileans getting to the speed of one at infinite frequency, would it also imply in some sense that we have some sort of a medium or it's completely vacuum effect, you call it?
No, that's completely vacuum. It's not vacuum. You have this background configuration, this medium, which is what gives rise to the...
But it's not Lorentz breaking, right? So it's this configuration is...
No, the configuration itself is Lorentz breaking.
Is it?
The configuration itself is Lorentz breaking.
Okay.
Yeah, because it's localized here. Yeah.
In that sense, it's very similar to the standard situation with the medium.
So I think if it does work out at higher frequency, I think the way it would more work out is that as you go to higher frequency, the Van Schillen mechanism makes it that you actually need to... Not only consider what's going in your neighborhood of your in your medium near you, but you really need to start probing what's going on at larger and larger distances. And at larger and larger distances, the medium becomes more and more irrelevant of the localized
Lorentz breaking medium, if that works out. But it's really intrinsic to the Wallenstein mechanism where you start becoming more relevant, more sensitive to things further away when you go to higher frequency.
Next question.
Yeah, just at the classical level, do some of these modified gravity theories or massive gravity theories have positive energy theorems? Positive energy. General relativity has a theorem that the ADM energy is positive in the asymptotically flat case. Do any of these theories have that property?
No, I don't think so.
So that is, it's known that the energy is not bounded from below?
You definitely have some configurations for which the energy is not bounded from below. And you can see that in the Galilean already. There will be configuration for which that happens. I think the real question is whether you will be able to reach these configurations within the regime of validity of your theory.
What do you mean by the region of validity?
So you can find classical configurations for which the energy would be unbounded from below. But if you start with a flat space time with just perturbed matter on top of it, you can ask the question of whether you can reach these other classical configurations without also needing to account for an infinite sum of quantum corrections, all the loops into account, which would...
But purely as classical theories, they're unstable.
No, but the classical theory might break down at the transition.
Is there any example of a classical theory which is unstable, which has a good quantization at all, even in ordinary quantum mechanics?
I mean, on flat space-time, yeah.
Just saying at high frequency, it's obvious it would look bad, but maybe that's outside the regime of validity.
Right.
No, but I understand that, but I'm just wondering how strong your hope is. That is, there are not, I don't know of any examples of a theory which is classically unstable, which has a stable quantum mechanics. Maybe.
I wouldn't be worried that we don't know other examples because this really relies on the kinetic structure for that to happen. So in another theory, you might not go out of control of the theory as easily because it's not precisely relying on redressing the kinetic structure of the field.
Next question. Okay, so in that case, let's thank Claudia again.
Thank you.